Welcome, everyone. Happy Easter or whatever you're celebrating. My name is Janet Cornwell. I'm a member of the High Watch and an interning mentor with the Prosperos, and I am very pleased to welcome you all to the Prosperos Sunday meeting today. The Prosperos, as you all know, is a school of ontology, the science or study of being. Our goal is to make spiritual truth an effective force for ordered freedom and common good. We work toward this goal by transcending the ancient definition of man as limited by dimension expectations and learned behaviors. Our teachings draw from many disciplines and philosophies, creating our unique approach to finding and realizing each person's true identity as beingness and consciousness. Now, we have classes. We are looking forward to two classes later this spring. On the 20th of April, Hugh John Mahlanopy will present his unique approach to accessing your unconscious in his lucid dreaming class. And on May 18th and 19th, Anne Bowman will present our advanced seminar class in a combination of live instruction and recorded lessons by Thane. You can get information about these on the website, and I will also, towards the end of the meeting, put the information and a link in the chat box so you can find it and get more information. We recommend both classes, and you can, again, find out more about them on the website, and you can register there as well. And for your inspirational enjoyment, we have scheduled two Sunday meetings in April and two more coming up in May. Information will be posted on our website and sent out in individual email notices, as well as being noted in the monthly community update that comes out. But we urge you to check the calendar on our website regularly because other interesting and inspiring events are always being added. Let's have a moment of settling and stillness before what promises to be a fascinating look at restructuring. I have the privilege today of introducing as our speaker the Dean of the Prosperos, William Finney, High Watch Mentor. William has been with the school since 1973. Giving dedicated study and service. He has a long record of accomplishment with the school over these years. He has served as a speaker, volunteer, High Watch member, mentor, instructor, trustee, private secretary to our founder, Thane, at that difficult time leading up to the end of the man's life. And as I said, he is now dean of the school. William is dedicated to education, especially the therapeutic education that the Prosperos offers. And he is especially dedicated to seeing that the school continues to share its unique principles, practices, and promise with both the Prosperos community and the world at large. Today, William will address the topic, The Magic of Restructuring, which investigates the challenges and rewards of taking a fresh view, not forgetting the power of genuine resurrection. William? Happy.
Thank you, Janet. I just need to get my notes together here. When you have your notes on an electronic object, you have to keep the electronic object turned on. So it's great to see everybody. It's great to see some faces of people I haven't seen in a long time. I think, Randy, the last time we saw each other was when we moved the curacy from one place to another, which was one bugger of a task. So yeah, it's great to see everybody. I think there was one thing I wanted to share, which is a note that I found on my desk a couple days ago, and it was at my work office. I'm responsible for replacing and upkeep of the computers for our small center at the University of Maryland. And on my desk was this note. It said, memory storage seems to have fallen off. Battery takes a long time to charge, doesn't last the way it used to. And I looked and I couldn't find what device they were talking about. I didn't know what what device do they mean? And then I realized that the note was not from my work at all. It was a HiWatch translation service request. So speaking of the HiWatch translation service, that's a service that our HiWatch members provide to anyone, where they will translate any situation that you bring to their attention. And the power of translation is something I hope we can explore a little bit here. But it's the power of moving from the dimensional side of life, the dimensional way of looking at life, to a way of seeing the abstract principles of life that are eternal and ongoing. This is a real key to this particular holiday in the Christian calendar, the Easter holiday, because we're very much interested in what happens when you say goodbye to a pattern that maybe has become quite dear to you, a pattern that has you kind of tied into a certain kind of role. And it can be appear to be painful, but at the moment that you do it, there's a possibility of something that's akin to resurrection. Another thing I noticed this week before getting into the proper talk, there was a great little piece by Dave Pell, that's P-E-L-L. He runs a service where he does clippings, I guess is the best way to say it. He goes around the internet and picks up the most interesting stories of the day and puts them in a little digest, which is very, very digestible, very easy to read, and can save you hours if you just check it out. Anyway, one of his topics was something he called card carrying, in that he says, we breathe in about 16 bits of microplastic every hour, the equivalent of a credit card each week. That's just something to think about. So while you're getting into debt, debt is getting into you. All right, so going back now to our question of Easter. Easter is the holiday in the Christian calendar where we celebrate, that is to say, Christians celebrate the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And our interpretation of that story, and I think it's really important to understand that it is a story, that everything we know in terms of the Bible, stories in the Bible, are all stories that have been collected about our sense of identity and our sense of what is true. So the meaning of this story, the resurrection of Jesus, is all tied up with the story of Jesus. And the story of Jesus has been, there's an Orthodox version, and there's, I guess, what I would call an unorthodox version. And these are very well explained by Elaine Pagels in her books about the Gnostic Gospels. There are two of them, actually. Trying to remember the name of the second one. She did a, like a revised version. Anyway, what we're interested in is the kind of activity, and this is what translation's all about, where each person's salvation is seen to be in their own hands. So the story of Easter and the story of salvation that comes from that, in our perspective, the salvation that any person is looking for. And of course, you know, people can get into the most difficult circumstances. There are issues of history, there are issues of family, there are many, many kinds of issues that might bring a person to the point where they want salvation. That is to say, they want to be in some way removed from the crisis that they're in. And this comes on many levels. There are minor irritations, and then there are major things. And the power of the celebration of Easter, the power of the resurrection image, is the promise that a person can be delivered from the what in the old days we would call the sinful world, world of iniquity and terribleness, into a divine state. And of course, the traditions that we know about mostly talk about that process happening at the moment that you die, and then you're judged by the ultimate judge, the God of Almighty of the universe. And then from there, you decide which way, or it is decided which way you're going to go. And the Prospero says, well, no, that doesn't have to take that long. It doesn't have to be when you die. And in fact, dying can be a kind of way of life for you, in the sense of dying to something that is not actually part of your innate self. A role that you've taken on, a role that has come to you, it may be not something you took on purpose, right? Something that came to you because of where you grew up, attitudes that you had by where you grew up. Like I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania in a Roman Catholic family and an Irish family. And believe me, being an Irishman was a big identity. It was a big thing. In fact, I went to visit my sister a couple days ago, and she told us a story about meeting her husband. And when she met her husband, they were at a bar, and something happened that induced him to talk to her. And when he started talking to her, she said to him, "Are you Irish?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Are you Catholic?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Do you want to have a big family?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Okay, I'll date you." Now, honestly, this is the reason why I never dated Irish women, because they're loaded for bear and they're coming for you, right? So I've always had much more luck with Italian lovers. But anyway, but as you see, though, there's a sense of identity, and it doesn't matter whether you cross the country or whether you stay in the same town. I had the dubious experience of going back to my hometown for the 50th celebration of graduation for with the alumni. And I'm talking to all these guys that are lawyers and pathologists and doctors, and because it was a prep school, right? So that's what everybody was doing. They like, I think 40% of them at least went to law school, right? And there was still, among those people, there were still all of these traditions around Irishness. And one of them was that they had an open bar, and they had the very best whiskeys that I have ever seen in one place in a bar. So, I mean, that's gives you the sense of how you can be invested in something, right? You're invested in it so much, and because it has all of these benefits. Being part of that club has these enormous benefits. And so you might not think of that as something that you need salvation from, or that you need to lay aside, until you run into a situation where you realize that you're, for me, it was when I realized that identifying myself as an Irishman was to identify with myself with somebody who liked to go to pubs and get into fights. And I thought to myself, you know, I really don't want that. That's not what I want from my identity and who I am. And so I had to translate the things of what you might call the shortcomings of that identity to get to some attributes that are much more interesting and less troubling. Another thing that we've been moving, that has come up as an issue in the translation service lately is this idea of mobility. I've had this issue to deal with myself, and it's in terms of not so much physical mobility, because my physical mobility is decent. thanks to Al Haferkamp, who gave me some fabulous exercises to use to work on my lower back. My mobility is fairly secure every day. But your mobility can also be your sense of being hemmed in. Mobility can also be a sense of not being able to leave a situation that you need to leave or that is calling for you to make a change. That's another way of being immobilized. And so as I was working on this, I began to understand, because now we have a whole room full of translators here, and I'm not going out of school if I start talking about translation in a more in-depth way. But getting to understand the nature of allness, which is truth. Truth is that which is so. That which is not truth is not so. Therefore, truth is all there is. And thinking that through, really genuinely thinking it through, and talking to your soma and telling your soma those words, you get to an understanding of allness. And when you understand allness, and you understand that allness is omnipresent, then you begin to see that in the allness, omnipresent allness, there isn't any place for anything to get in the way. So you begin to understand that the nature of truth, the nature of beingness, is movement, or freedom of movement is maybe better said. As you work in translating, you begin to get a better sense of what life is, which is to say, beingness. Truth is that which is so, that which is being. And so freedom of movement is the movingness of life. That is to say that life is boundless. That which is all there is boundless. So that life itself is moving in the sense that being is not static. Being is not an object. It's not a thing that is contained somewhere. That's the trouble. Beingness or being, it doesn't end. If it ended, you would have a place where being is and a place where there's nothing. In other words, two-ness. That which is all there is all. And the energy or life or aliveness is intrinsic and natural to that which is all there is. So in a way of saying it, you could say that the being, the verb, and being as existence, they're equivalent. Being is aliveness, and aliveness is movingness. Aliveness is constantly changing. Aliveness is constantly fresh, constantly new. That which is infinite or boundless is constantly fresh, constantly new, constantly alive. So, and that which is constantly fresh and new and alive is when we talk about infinite being, is we're talking about endless newness. This is what Norma Keller used to call changeless change. It is the essence of being, that is to say, being alive, and it is endlessly unbegun. It is endlessly something new. And you, this moment, have the opportunity or the possibility that you also can be something new in the next moment. Having that possibility and actually engaging it are two different things. It's very sad in a way that really there are lots and lots of people who live their lives in a complex of entrenchments. Let's go over that a little bit. Entrenchment is digging in. Entrenchment is preparing defenses for an expected assault. There are people that I work with in my office who have it's almost visible, the lines that they've drawn around themselves as defenses against any kind of an expected attack. And boy, are they ready. They're just ready to put you in your place if you bring up some new idea. Anyway, for us in a meeting like this, the idea is to look around in your own life, find the little places where you have an inner earthworks that are either great or small. And as you do some examining of your own life, you can see where there may be just a little line somewhere. Okay, here's a little line that I'm drawing right here. This is the line that I'm drawing. And right now, it's just a little line. But as you go on, if you don't do something about that, what's going to happen is it's going to get bigger. And it's going to get bigger and bigger until you have yourself a real trench. And then nobody can get in, and you can't get out, and life is not flowing. And that's the thing that's the most important part of it, is that your life stops flowing because of the entrenchments that are built up around whatever the little things are, where you're ready for a fight. And so you become, instead of the fabulous flowingness of your own beingness, your life becomes a parody, or it can become a parody, without taking some sort of steps. And you've met some of these people. They're grimacing, they're angry, they're outraged, or they have this feeling of being put upon by people. They're cut off from the natural flowingness of life. It doesn't help. Our current political scene does not help us in this matter, because it's just a golden opportunity for building trenches. There's so much to hate. There's so much to fear. There's so much to detest. So many categories of, well, if only this or if only that. With all of this atmosphere, and with the temptation, then, of course, that you're to identify with one side or the other. And this is the big challenge. How to look at the current situation, and it doesn't matter whether you're looking at big political things or whether your own family life, how to regard it and how to approach it without identifying with one side or the other. Because as soon as you pile on and say, oh, well, I believe this, and those other guys over there are all full of it, you're in a trench. And it's very hard from that position to get to anything that's genuine, or get to anything that is connected with the ongoingness and the flowingness of infinite being and infinite life. I mean, the Prospero stands for a point of view that says life is boundless. And life as each individual person is boundless in an infinite variety of ways. So each of us has a unique way of being the boundlessness of life. Then, if we throw it away and dig ourselves in a certain place with a certain opinion, even a well-formed opinion, if it cuts you off from being able to flow with life, reach out a hand, for example, or turn away from conflict that is offering itself to you, as alternatives, you're in a situation where you eventually might want to get salvation for that, because you've found yourself in a created a, an entrenchment that you can't get out of. And as far as knowledge is concerned and opinions, Alana listens to some fabulous podcasts from different podcasters, and they're full of opinions. And the thing that gets me about the podcasters is that they're always very happy to make somebody else look like a total jerk. Oh, well, X says this, and isn't that just silly? And then they all laugh. Oh, yes, how silly it is that X says this, or Y says that. Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. And so all puffed up ego making comments about, well, honestly, other puffed up egos, but there you are. Anyway, as far as information goes, Mr. Krishnamurti observes in many places in his work that one of the things that we suffer from is the sense of fragmentation. And if we look at our political scene, fragmentation is probably the best word to translate, or one of the best ones. Anyway, his point, Mr. Krishnamurti's point, was that applying thought to any kind of a fragmented situation, what it does is it creates more fragments. Applying knowledge, he had a very poor opinion of knowledge. But it's important to remember that when you read Krishnamurti, what he speaks about when he says knowledge, he means everything that's coming out of your construct field. He's talking about everything that you've accepted as received ideas or conditioned ideas because you grew up in a certain place. And that kind of knowledge, when it's applied to a fragmentary problem, creates many, many more fragments. George Steiner is one of my favorite authors. I did a stint of studying translation studies. And George Steiner wrote a fabulous book called After Babel. And it was about translation studies. It was about the challenges of translating from one language to another and the theories around what makes translation a good translation or a bad translation. Now we're talking about literary translation here, not Prospero's translation, but it's still about language. And he said that when his book first came out, that up till that time, there had never been a full-scale endeavor to relate or to bring into interactive focus diverse areas of rhetoric, literary history, linguistics, and linguistic philosophy. There had been no ordered or detailed attempt to locate translation at the heart of human communication, or to explore the ways in which the constraints on translatability and the potentialities of transfers between languages engage at the most immediate and charged level the philosophic inquiry into consciousness and into the meaning of meaning. So now this is really interesting stuff for somebody like me who's been working with words all my life and understanding my translation projects are mostly French into English. You always translate into your native language. So you want to start out with, and then the question becomes, well, where is the translator? From English into French or French into English, is the translator a French speaker and then they become English? Or are they an English speaker and they try to understand French? And where is the translator? And in my papers, when I was doing this, I made the assertion that the translator is consciousness. And the translator is neither French nor English. The translator is consciousness, and it's navigating these two places. Anyway, he goes on, and this is my point. George Steiner writes, inevitably, such an attempt at innovative synthesis will be vulnerable. If you do innovation of any kind, you are putting yourself in a position of vulnerability. To an extent almost defiant of common sense, he writes, approved academic studies have fragmented into minute specialization. The parish grows smaller with every teaching appointment or research project. The sanctioned vision is microscopic. More and more is being published in learned journals and by academic presses about less and less. The note is one of Byzantine minutiae, of commentaries on commentaries on commentaries towering like inverted pyramids on single points. And each of these points is itself is ephemeral. And then he goes on to say that the specialist holds the generalist or the polymath in disrespect and kind of takes refuge in his authority and technical grasp over a given inch of ground, as it were. Then he concludes, among stamp collectors, letter writers are not always welcome. Now, what was all that about? Inverted pyramids. building up and building up and building up and building up something out of one particular point to the point where you lose any perspective on the whole thing. It is the embellishment of fragmentation. It's kind of Baroque, where you have flowers and cupids and all this other stuff all tied on to this one little point that you're trying to make. And so the application of knowledge in terms of what we know often ends up creating situations that are way more complicated and way less easy to deal with. And then finally, that brings us, if we're going to be on Easter, we may as well go back to the Bible and say, from the Gospel of Matthew, which of you by taking thought can add one cubit to your stature? So I found very interesting that the translations, the various translations of this verse in different Bibles, because now you have like 12 or 15 different versions of the Bible for different applications. And the taking thought in this verse is often considered by, in many of the other translations, to be worrying. That worrying is what taking thought means in this context. And I think they got it wrong. I think taking thought means thinking that you, by applying your conditioned knowledge, can actually create something creative. Now, in the Prosperous, we give a lot of attention to the idea of thought, because translation is a process of using words and using the mind to arrive at a conclusion. But it's important to say that we create or we observe an important distinction, and that is that the thoughts of the reality self are oceans apart from the thoughts of the conditioned ego that is trying to bring all of this to task. It's through thought that we solve problems. There are inventions and things that are useful to us today that came from the application of thought. I think we're all, maybe a little bit tired of the application of thought when we look at all of the technologies that are kind of jumping on top of us now and creating all sorts of challenges. What I mean is by AI and all of the, I mean, that is a supreme challenge. That is an amazing challenge that needs to be digested. And in so many ways, it needs to be examined. And it's coming fast and furious. And this is part of what creates the sense of anxiety and the sense of things are out of control. I don't know what's going to come next. I can't even trust my phone to not track me, all these things. So we agree in the Prosperous with Mr. Krishnamurti's idea that just dumping accepted, received ideas on top of a given situation is not the answer. And in fact, in engineering, it's a kind of an old saw now, but it's well understood that if you're on deadline and you have an engineering project that needs to get completed, when you're on deadline, then the bean counters will say, well, let's just add more engineers, and that way we'll get it done faster. And adding even one more engineer is a guarantee that it's going to take 6 weeks longer. That's just, it's in the literature. You can read up on it. It's just a matter of recorded experience now. So adding another engineer or adding another voice to a situation that's already at the place where you need to, get it wrapped up as fast as you can is not the answer. But we in the Prosperous, we have what we call group dynamics. And in group dynamics, this can be really helpful, because in group dynamics, in a group discussion, if it's properly pursued, that is to say, it's not just a bull session, genuine group dynamics where you sit down and discuss some ideas, then the received ideas can be challenged. And this is where there's a benefit, because you have five people in a room, and if they have courage and they're willing to challenge the received ideas, And the challenge to received ideas is not taken as a personal affront, but actually something that can be useful. Then you can get unexpected outcomes, and you can get something quite unusual. In fact, you can expect that that will happen if the group dynamics situation is set up correctly. Then you have people's images of themselves. And so in a group situation, if an idea is challenged, they think it's their idea. In the Prospero's version of group dynamics, there are no personal ideas. There are no personal ideas. If it comes to the group, it's a group idea. And it doesn't matter that so-and-so said it, X, Y, or Z. It's an idea that the group is going to handle. So at the base, we're still in a situation where your sense of identity and your image, your inner landscape in terms of where you have built your barricades and where you have, free-flowing areas, all of that is something that is flexible. All of it is approachable if you use the tools of translation and releasing the hidden splendor. There is no problem that you can be confronted with where the tool of translation or release the hidden splendor will not make an impact. Every time, those tools will make an impact. And that means maybe you need a counselor to help you to work through, well, I can't quite get this sense testimony right, or I can't quite get to where do I go to manage this memory that seems to be coming up here, this repeating pattern that I'm in. And your counselor's job is to help you find those things. But ultimately, it's you that does the work. You who sits down and decides, yes, I want salvation from this mess, this thing that I'm dealing with. So if you wish to experience the flow of life, really experiencing it, the first step is to understand that it's all around you. And it is you. Every moment. You won't be able to enjoy that until you make some progress filling in the earthworks, the entrenchments. But as you go about it, you go about a process of unlearning. You start where you are. You start with the little lines that you can find that you, okay, I can erase this one. Let me see if I can get rid of this little one before you go on to the big ones. You start where you are, what you can see. And I guarantee you that as soon as you take the first step, as soon as you make the first move to address one of these, your life will respond. You will get a reflection back from life saying, way to go, you're doing this. Now, I can't explain anything specifically about that. I'll tell a story though. It's a translation story. It's kind of out of context here, but I was first in my first days of learning translation. I was all gaga for it, but nobody else in my family knew about it. And one day there was a crisis. And now, this is a first world crisis. Okay, this is not a real crisis. This is somebody's house down the street. The Brennan's house was locked. And somebody had to be able to get into the Brennan's house to do something. And the Brennans were away on vacation. So how are we going to get into the house? And there was conversation, well, nobody has a key. And I thought we had a key, but do we have a key? Do we have a key to the Brennan's house? And so my father went back to our house to see if he could find the key to the Brennan's house. And he came back and I was standing away. I was standing probably 30 feet away from what was going on. He had the key out and he was at the back door and he was trying one key after another. He was like, duh, 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 no, that doesn't work. Duh, no, 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 that doesn't work. And I was translating and I was, truth is that which is so, that which is not truth, it's not so, for truth is all there is. And I kept going through the syllogism, and then I had an insight that truth being all there is, there can't be any inside and there can't be any outside. And there was a click. and the door was open. Now, is that cause and effect? No, it's not cause and effect, but it is a response from life telling you, you see, bud, this stuff has got legs. So as soon as you start working on any of these issues, you're going to get a response from life that will confirm for you the work that you're doing. And as soon as it happens for you, you will know it and appreciate it. Now that's the key to keep going. The prize, and there is a prize, is that your life is redeemed. So we're not talking about a person in history going to redeem you by their sacrifice. We're talking about the prize of your life is that your life is redeemed, and you discover that the life that you had before, as you go along on this path, you begin to see that the life you had, which was really, it was an imitation of the real you that came from received ideas, and that the real you is quite a bit different and with quite a bit more opportunities. So instead of living in a situation where you're living in an imitation of, or a kind of caricature, I guess, of your innate beingness, the genuine, unpredictable, and boundless truth of yourself, the other is puny by comparison. There's no doubt about it. So this is your birthright. It is your birthright to live fully and completely your innate beingness, your innate self. It's yours. It's waiting for your acceptance. And one of the characteristics of this innate beingness of yours and the innate beingness of every person is that it has the character of love. It has the character of wholeness, because allness is wholeness. And that is the truth of you and the truth of everyone in any of the scenes that you may be experiencing in your life. So I asked myself the question, this is the end, okay? I asked myself the question, what is the obverse of entrenchment? And I didn't get words as an answer, but what I saw was an image of natural structures. For example, in Hawaii, they've got rainforests, or even a beach where there's palm trees. So these natural structures, and the natural structures, they channel life's energies into greater and greater statements of what it means to be alive. They're flowing with life, and they're alive with life, and life is being them. So thank you so much for listening, and I wish you all a happy Easter.
Thank you so much, William.